by the way, is very important here. Not as important as clothes, obviously, but getting there. To humans, hair is more than just a filamentous biomaterial that happens to grow out of their heads. It carries all kinds of social signifiers, most of which I couldn't translate. His clothes were as black as space, and his T-shirt had the words dark matter on them. Maybe this was how certain people communicated, via the slogans on their T-shirts. He wore wristbands. His hands were in his pockets, and he seemed uncomfortable looking at my face. The feeling, then, was mutual. His voice was low, or at least low by human standards, about the same depth as a Vonodorian humming plant. He came and sat on the bed and tried to be nice at the start, but then at one point he switched to a higher frequency. "Dad, why did you do it?" "I don't know. School is going to be hell now." "Oh. Is that all you can say? Oh, are you serious? Is that fucking it?" "No. Yes, I fucking don't fucking know, Gulliver."
"Well, you've destroyed my life. I'm a joke. It was bad before, ever since I started there, but now..."
I wasn't listening. I was thinking about Daniel Russell and how I desperately needed to phone him. Gulliver noticed I wasn't paying attention.
"It doesn't even matter. You never want to talk to me. Apart from last night."
Gulliver left the room. He slammed the door and let out a kind of growl. He was 15 years old. This meant he belonged to a special subcategory of human called a teenager, the chief characteristics of which were a weakened resistance to gravity, a vocabulary of grunts, a lack of spatial awareness, copious amounts of masturbation, and an unending appetite for cereal. Last night. I got out of bed and headed upstairs to the attic. I knocked on his door. There was no reply, but I opened it anyway. Inside, the environment was one of prevailing dark. There were posters for musicians. Thermostat, Skrillex, The Fetid, Mother Night, and the dark matter his T-shirt referenced. There was a window sloped in line with the ceiling, but the blind was drawn. There was a book on the bed. It was called Ham on Rye by Charles Bukowski. There were clothes on the floor. Together, the room was a data cloud of despair. I sensed he wanted to be put out of his misery one way or another. That would come, of course, but first there would be a few more questions. He didn't hear me enter, owing to the audio transmitter he had plugged into his ears. Nor did he see me, as he was too busy staring at his computer. On the screen there was a still-motion image of myself, naked, walking past one of the university buildings. There was also some writing on the screen. At the top were the words, "Gulliver Martin, you must be so proud." Underneath there were lots of comments. A typical example read, "Ha ha 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 ha. Oh, almost forgot, ha." I read the name next to that particular post. "Who is Theo the fucking business clerk?" Gulliver jumped at my voice and turned around. I asked my question again, but didn't receive an answer. "What are you doing?" I asked, purely for research purposes.
"Just go away."
"I want to talk to you. I want to talk about last night." He turned his back to me. His torso stiffened.
"Go away, Dad."
"No, I want to know what I said to you." He sprang out of his chair and, as the humans say, stormed over to me.
"Just leave me alone, okay? You've never been interested in a single thing about my life, so don't start now. Why fucking start now?"
I watched the back of him in the small circular mirror staring out from the wall like a dull and unblinking eye. After some aggressive pacing, he sat back in his chair, turned to his computer again, and pressed his finger on an odd-looking command device. "I need to know something," I said. "I need to know if you know what I was doing last week at work."
"Dad, just
listen, this is important. Were you still up when I came home? You know, last night. Were you in the house? Were you awake?" He mumbled something. I didn't hear what. Only an ipsoid would have heard it. "Gulliver, how are you at mathematics?"
"You know how I fucking am at maths."
"Fucking no, I don't. Not now. That is why I'm fucking asking. Tell me what you fucking know." Nothing. I thought I was using his language, but Gulliver just sat there, staring away from me, with his right leg jerking up and down in slight but rapid movements. My words were having no effect. I thought of the audio transmitter he still had in one ear. Maybe it was sending radio signals. I waited a little while longer and sensed it was time to leave. But as I headed for the door, he said,
"Yeah, I was up. You told me."
My heart raced. "What? What did I tell you?"
"About you being the saviour of the human race or something."
"Anything more specific? Did I go into detail?"
"You proved your precious Rain Man hypothesis."
"Riemann? Riemann? The Riemann hypothesis? I told you that, fucking did I?"
"Yeah," he said in the same glum tone. "First time you'd spoken to me in a week."
"Who have you told?"
"What?
Dad, I think people are more interested in the fact that you walked around the town centre naked, to be honest. No one's going to care about some equation." "But your mother? Have you told her?" "She must have asked you if I'd spoken to you after I'd gone missing. Surely she asked you that." He shrugged. A shrug, I realised, was one of the main modes of communication for teenagers.
"Yeah."
"And? What did you say? Come on, speak to me, Gulliver. What does she know about it?" He turned and looked me straight in the eye. He was frowning, angry, confused.
"I don't fucking believe you, Dad."
"Fucking believe?
You're the parent. I'm the kid. I'm the one who should be wrapped up in myself, not you. I'm 15 and you're 43. If you are genuinely ill, Dad, then I want to be there for you. But aside from your newfound love of streaking and your weird fucking swearing, you are acting very, very, very much like yourself. But here's a newsflash. You ready? We don't actually care about your prime numbers. We don't care about your precious fucking work or your stupid fucking books or your genius-like brain or your ability to solve the world's greatest outstanding mathematical whatever. Because all these things hurt us."
"Hurt you?" Maybe the boy was wiser than he looked. "What do you mean by that?" His eyes stayed on me. His chest rose and fell with visible intensity.
"Nothing," he said at last. "But the answer is no, I didn't tell Mum. I said you said something about work, that's all. I didn't think it was relevant information right then to tell her about your fucking hypothesis."
"But the money, you know about that?"
"Yeah, course I do."
"And you still didn't think it was a big deal?"
"Dad, we have quite a lot of money in the bank. We have one of the biggest houses in Cambridge. I'm probably the richest kid in my school now. But it doesn't amount to shit. It isn't the purse, remember?"
"The purse?"
"That school you spent 20 grand a year on. You've forgotten that. Who the hell are you? Jason Bourne?"
"No, I'm not."
"You probably forgot I was expelled, too."
"No," I lied. "Course I haven't."
"I don't think more money's going to save us."
I was genuinely confused. This went against everything we were meant to know about the humans. "No," I said. "You're right. It won't. And besides, it was a mistake. I haven't proved the Riemann hypothesis. I think, in fact, it is unprovable. I thought I had, but I haven't. So there is nothing to tell anyone." At which Gulliver pushed the audio transmission device into his other ear and closed his eyes. He wanted no more of me. "Fucking okay," I whispered, and left the room. Emily Dickinson. I went downstairs and found an address book. Inside were addresses and telephone numbers for people, listed alphabetically. I found the telephone number I was looking for. A woman told me Daniel Russell was out, but would be back in around an hour. He would phone me back. Meanwhile, I perused some more history books and learnt things as I read between the lines. As well as religion, human history is full of depressing things like Colonization, disease, racism, sexism, homophobia, class snobbery, environmental destruction, slavery, totalitarianism, military dictatorships, inventions of things which they have no idea how to handle, the atomic bomb, the internet, the semicolon, the victimization of clever people, the worshipping of idiotic people, boredom, despair, periodic collapses, and catastrophes within the psychic landscape. And through it all, there has always been some truly awful food. I found a book called The Great American Poets. "I believe a leaf of grass is no less than the journey work of the stars," wrote someone called Walt Whitman. It was an obvious point, but something about it was quite beautiful. In the same book there were words written by another poet. The poet was Emily Dickinson. The words were these: "How happy is the little stone that rambles in the road alone, and doesn't care about careers, and exigencies never fears, whose coat of elemental brown a passing universe put on, and, independent as the sun, associates or glows alone, fulfilling absolute decree in casual simplicity." Fulfilling absolute decree, I thought. Why do these words trouble me? The dog growled at me. I turned the page and found more unlikely wisdom. I read the words aloud to myself. "The soul should always stand ajar, ready to welcome the ecstatic experience." "You're out of bed," said Isabel. "Yes," I said. "To be a human is to state the obvious, repeatedly, over and over, until the end of time." "You need to eat," she added, after studying my face. "Yes," I said. She got out some ingredients. Gulliver walked past the doorway. "Gull, where are you going? I'm making dinner." The boy said nothing as he left. The slam of the door almost shook the house. "I'm worried about him," said Isabel. As she worried, I studied the ingredients on the worktop. Mainly green vegetation, but then something else. Chicken breast. I thought about this, and I kept thinking, the breast of a chicken, the breast of a chicken, the breast of a chicken. "That looks like meat," I said. "I'm going to make a stir fry." "With that?" "Yes, the breast of a chicken." "Yes, Andrew, or are you vegetarian now?" The dog was in his basket. It went by the name of Newton. It was still growling at me. "What about the dog's breasts? Are we going to eat those, too?"
"No," she said, with resignation. I was testing her.
"Is a dog more intelligent than a chicken?"
"Yes," she said.
She closed her eyes.
"I don't know. No, I haven't got time for this. Anyway, you're the big meat eater."
I was uncomfortable. I would rather not eat the chicken's breasts. Isabel now clenched, her eyes closed. She inhaled deeply.
"Give me strength," she whispered.
I could have done so, of course, but I needed what strength I had right now. Isabel handed me my diazepam.
"Have you taken one lately?"
"No."
"You probably should."
So I humoured her. I unscrewed the cap and placed a pill on my palm. These ones looked like word capsules, as green as knowledge. I popped a tablet in my mouth. "Be careful." Dishwasher. I ate the vegetable stir-fry. It smelt like Basidian body waste. I tried not to look at it. So I looked at Isabel instead. It was the first time that looking at a human face was the easiest option. But I did need to eat. So I ate. "When you spoke to Gulliver about me going missing, did he say anything to you?"
"Yes," she said.
"What was it that he said?"
"That you came in about 11, and that you'd gone into the living room where he was watching TV, and that you'd told him that you were sorry you were late, but you'd been finishing something off at work."
"Was that it? There was nothing more specific?"
"No."
"What do you think he meant by that?" I mean, what I meant by that.
I don't know. But I have to say, you coming home and being friendly to Gulliver, that's already out of character.
Why? Don't I like him?
Not since 2 years ago. No. Pains me to say it, but you don't act very much like you do.
2 years ago?
Since he got expelled from Perse. For starting a fire.
Oh, yes. The fire incident.
I want you to start making an effort with him.
Afterwards, I followed Isabel into the kitchen, putting my plate and cutlery in the dishwasher. I was noticing more things about her. At first, I had just seen her as generically human, but now I was appreciating the details. Picking up things I hadn't noticed. Differences between her and the others. She was wearing a cardigan and blue trousers known as jeans. Her long neck was decorated with a thin necklace made out of silver. Her eyes stared deep into things, as though she was continually searching for something that wasn't there, or as if it was there but just out of sight. It was as though everything had a depth, an internal distance to it.
"How are you feeling?"
she asked. She seemed worried about something. "I feel fine."
"I only ask because you're loading the dishwasher."
"Because that's what you are doing."
"Andrew, you never load the dishwasher. You are, and I mean this in the least offensive way possible, something of a domestic primitive."
"Why? Don't mathematicians load dishwashers?"
"In this house," she said sadly. "No, actually. No, they don't."
"Oh, yes. I know. Obviously. I just fancied helping today. I help sometimes."
"Now we're on to fractions."
She looked at my jumper. There was a bit of noodle resting on the blue wool. She picked it off and stroked the fabric where it had been. She smiled quickly. She cared about me. She had her reservations, but she cared. I didn't want her to care about me. It wouldn't help things. She placed her hand through my hair to tidy it a bit. To my surprise, I wasn't flinching.
"Einstein chic is one thing, but this is ridiculous," she said softly.
I smiled like I understood. She smiled too, but it was a smile on top of something else, as if she was wearing a mask and there was a near identical but less smiling face underneath.
"It's almost like an alien clone is in my kitchen."
"Almost," I said. "Yes." It was then that the telephone rang. Isabel went to answer it, and a moment later came back into the kitchen, holding out the receiver.
"It's for you,"
she said, in a suddenly serious voice. Her eyes were wide, trying to convey a silent message I didn't quite understand. "Hello," I said. There was a long pause. The sound of breath, and then a voice on the next exhalation. A man, talking slowly and carefully.
"Andrew, is that you?"
"Yes, who's this?"
"It's Daniel. Daniel Russell."
My heart tripped. I realized this was it, the moment things had to change. "Oh, hello, Daniel."
"How are you? I hear you might be unwell."
"Oh, I'm fine, really. It was just a little bit of mental exhaustion. My mind had run its own marathon, and it struggled. My brain is made for sprints. It doesn't have the stamina for long-distance running. But don't worry, honestly, I am back where I was. It wasn't anything too serious. Nothing that the right medication couldn't suppress, anyway."
"Well, that is good to hear. I was worried about you. Anyway, I was hoping to talk to you about that remarkable email you sent me."
"Yes," I said, "but let's not do this over the phone. Let's chat face to face. It would be good to see you." Isabel frowned.
"What a good idea. Should I come to you?"
"No," I said, with a degree of firmness. "No, I'll come to you." We are waiting. A large house. Isabel had offered to drive me, and had tried to insist on it, saying I wasn't ready to leave the house. Of course, I had already left the house to go to Fitzwilliam College, but she hadn't known about that. I said I felt like some exercise, and Daniel needed to speak to me quite urgently about something, possibly some kind of job offer. I told her I'd have my phone on me and that she knew where I was, and so eventually I was able to take the address from Isabel's notebook, leave the house, and head to Babraham. To a large house, the largest I'd seen. Daniel Russell's wife answered the door. She was a very tall, broad-shouldered woman, with quite long grey hair and aged skin.
"Oh, Andrew!"
She held out her arms wide. I replicated the gesture, and she kissed me on the cheek. She smelt of soap and spices. It was clear she knew me. She couldn't stop saying my name.
"Andrew, Andrew, how are you?"
she asked me.
"I heard about your little misadventure."
"Well, I'm all right. It was a, well, an episode. But I'm over it. The story continues." She studied me a little more, and then opened the door wide. She beckoned me inside, smiling broadly. I stepped into the hallway. "Do you know why I'm here?"
"To see him upstairs,"
she said, pointing to the ceiling. "Yes, but do you know why I'm here to see him?" She was puzzled by my manner, but she tried her best to hide it beneath a kind of energetic and chaotic politeness.
"No, Andrew," she said quickly. "As a matter of fact, he didn't say."
I nodded. I noticed a large ceramic vase on the floor. It had a yellow pattern of flowers on it, and I wondered why people bothered with such empty vessels. What was their significance? Maybe I would never know. We passed a room with a sofa and a television and bookcases and dark red walls, blood-coloured.
"Do you want a coffee? Fruit juice? We've acquired a taste for pomegranate juice, though Daniel believes antioxidants are a marketing ploy."
"I would like a water, if that's okay." We were in the kitchen now. It was about twice the size of Andrew Martin's kitchen, but it was so cluttered it felt no bigger. There were saucepans hanging above my head. There was an envelope on the unit addressed to Daniel and Tabitha Russell. Tabitha poured me water from a jug.
"I'd offer you a slice of lemon, but I think we're out. There's one in the bowl, but it must be blue by now. The cleaners never sort the fruit out. They won't touch it. And Daniel won't eat fruit, even though the doctor has told him he's got to. But then the doctor has told him to relax and slow down, too, and he doesn't do that either."
"Oh? Why?" She looked baffled.
"His heart attack. You remember that? You aren't the only frazzled mathematician in the world."
"Oh," I said. "How is he?"
"Well, he's on beta blockers. I'm trying to get him on muesli and skimmed milk, and to take it easier."
"His heart," I said, thinking aloud.
"Yes, his heart."
"That is one of the reasons I came, in fact." She handed me a glass, and I took a sip. As I did so, I thought of the startling capacity for belief inherent in this species. Even before I'd fully discovered the concepts of astrology, homeopathy, organized religion, and probiotic yogurts, I was able to work out that what humans may have lacked in physical attractiveness, they made up for in gullibility. You could tell them anything in a convincing enough voice, and they would believe it. Anything, of course, except the truth. "Where is he?"
"In his study, upstairs."
"His study?"
"You know where that is, don't you?"
"Of course. Of course. I know where that is." Daniel Russell. Of course, I had been lying. I had no idea where Daniel Russell's study was, and this was a very big house. But as I was walking along the first floor landing, I heard a voice, the same dry voice I had heard on the phone.
"Is that the saviour of mankind?"
I followed the voice all the way to the third doorway on the left, which was half open. I could see framed pieces of paper lining a wall. I pushed open the door and saw a bald man with a sharp, angular face and a small, in human terms, mouth. He was smartly dressed. He was wearing a red bow tie and a checked shirt.
"Pleased to see you're wearing clothes,"
he said, suppressing a sly smile.
Our neighbours are people of delicate sensibilities.
Yes, I am wearing the right amount of clothes. Don't worry about that. He nodded, and kept nodding, as he leant back in his chair and scratched his chin. A computer screen glowed behind him, full of Andrew Martin's curves and formulas. I could smell coffee. I noticed an empty cup, two of them, in fact.
I have looked at it, and I have looked at it again. This must have taken you to the edge, I can see that. This is something. You must have been burning yourself with this, Andrew. I've been burning just reading through it.
I worked very hard, I said. I was lost in it. But that happens, doesn't it, with numbers? He listened with concern.
Did they prescribe anything?
He asked. Diazepam.
Do you feel it's working?
I do. I do. I feel it is working. Everything feels a little bit alien, I would say, a tad otherworldly, as if the atmosphere is slightly different, and the gravity has slightly less pull, and even something as familiar as an empty coffee cup has a terrible difference to it. You know, from my perspective. Even you. You seem quite hideous to me. Almost terrifying. Daniel Russell laughed. It wasn't a happy laugh.
Well, there's always been a frisson between us, but I always put that down to academic rivalry.
Par for the course.
We're not geographers or biologists. We're numbers men. We mathematicians have always been like that. Look at that miserable bastard Isaac Newton.
I named my dog after him.
So you did. But listen, Andrew, this isn't a moment to nudge you to the curb. This is a moment to slap you on the back.
We were wasting time. Have you told anyone about this? He shook his head.
No, of course not. Andrew, this is yours. You can publicize this how you want, though I would probably advise you, as a friend, to wait a little while, at least a week or so, until all this unwelcome stuff about your little corpus incident has died down.
Is mathematics less interesting for humans than nudity?
It tends to be, Andrew. Yes. Listen, go home. Take it easy this week. I'll put a word in with Diane at Fitz and explain that you will be fine, but you may need some time off. I'm sure she'll be pretty flexible. The students are going to be tricky on your first day back. You need to build your strength up. Rest a while. Come on, Andrew. Go home.
I could smell the foul scent of coffee getting stronger. I looked around at all the certificates on the wall and felt thankful to come from a place where personal success was meaningless. Home, I said. Do you know where that is?
Of course I do. Andrew, what are you talking about?
Actually, I'm not called Andrew. Another nervous chuckle.
Is Andrew Martin your stage name? If it is, I could have thought of better.
I don't have a name. Names are a symptom of a species which values the individual self above the collective good. This was the first time he stood up out of his chair. He was a tall man, taller than me.
This would be amusing, Andrew, if you weren't a friend. I really think you might need to get proper medical help for this. Listen, I know a very good psychiatrist who you...
Andrew Martin is someone else. He was taken.
Taken?
After he proved what he proved, we were left with no choice.
We? What are you talking about? Just have an objective ear, Andrew. You are sounding out of your mind. I think you ought to go home. I'll drive you back. I think it would be safer. Come on, let's go. I'll take you home. Back to your family.
He held out his right arm, gesturing towards the door. But I wasn't going anywhere. The pain. You said you wanted to slap my back. He frowned. Above the frown, the skin covering the top of his skull shone. I stared at it. At the shine.
What?
You wanted to slap my back. That is what you said. So why not?
What?
Slap my back. Then I will go.
Andrew!
Slap my back. He exhaled slowly. His eyes were the midpoint between concern and fear. I turned, gave him my back, waited for the hand, then waited some more. Then it came. He slapped my back. On that first contact, even with clothes between us, I made the reading. Then, when I turned, for less than a second, my face wasn't Andrew Martin's. It was mine.
What the...
He lurched backwards, bumping into his desk. I was, to his eyes, Andrew Martin again. But he had seen what he had seen. I only had a second before he would begin screaming, so I paralyzed his jaw. Somewhere way below the panic of his bulging eyes, there was a question. How did he do that? To finish the job properly, I would need another contact. My left hand on his shoulder was sufficient. Then the pain began, the pain I had summoned. He held his arm. His face became violet, the colour of home. I had pain too, head pain, and fatigue. But I walked past him as he dropped to his knees and deleted the email in the attachment. I checked his scent folder, but there was nothing suspicious. I stepped out onto the landing.
Tabitha! Tabitha, call an ambulance! Quick, I think Daniel is having a heart attack.
Egypt. Less than a minute later, she was upstairs, on the phone, her face full of panic as she knelt down, trying to push a pill, an aspirin, into her husband's mouth.
His mouth won't open! His mouth won't open! Daniel, open your mouth! Darling, oh my God, darling, open your mouth!
And then to the phone.
Yes, I told you, the Hollies. Yes, Chaucer Road. He's dying.
She managed to cram inside her husband's mouth a piece of the pill, which bubbled into foam and dribbled onto the carpet. Her husband was saying desperately. I stood there watching him. His eyes stayed wide, wide open, ipsoid wide, as if staying in the world was a simple matter of forcing yourself to see.
Daniel, it's all right,
Tabitha was saying, right into his face.
An ambulance is on its way. You'll be okay, darling.
His eyes were now on me. He jerked in my direction. He was trying to warn his wife. She didn't understand. Tabitha was stroking her husband's hair with a manic tenderness.
Daniel, we're going to Egypt. Come on, think of Egypt. We're going to see the pyramids. It's only 2 weeks till we go. Come on, it's going to be beautiful. You've always wanted to go.
As I watched her, I felt a strange sensation. A kind of longing for something, a craving. But for what? I had no idea. I was mesmerized by the sight of this human female crouched over the man whose blood I had prevented from reaching his heart.
You got through it last time, and you'll get through it this time.
No, I whispered, unheard. No, no, no. He said, gripping his shoulder in infinite pain.
I love you, Daniel.
His eyes clenched shut now, the pain too much.
Stay with me. Stay with me. I can't live all alone.
His head was on her knee. She kept caressing his face. So this was love. Two life forms in mutual reliance. I was meant to be thinking I was watching weakness, something to scorn. But I wasn't thinking that at all. He stopped making noise. He seemed instantly heavier for her, and the deep, clenched creases around his eyes softened and relaxed. It was done. Tabitha howled as if something had been physically wrenched out of her. I've never heard anything like that sound. It troubled me greatly, I have to say. A cat emerged from the doorway, startled by the noise, maybe, but indifferent to the scene in general. It returned back from where it came.
No,
said Tabitha. Over and over.
No, no, no.
Outside, the ambulance skidded to a halt on the gravel. blue flashing lights appeared through the window. "They're here," I told Tabitha, and went downstairs. It was a strange and overwhelming relief to tread my way down those soft, carpeted stairs, and for those desperate sobs and futile commands to fade away into nothing. Where we are from. I thought about where we, you and I, are from. Where we are from, there are no comforting delusions, no religions, no impossible fiction. Where we are from, there is no love and no hate. There is the purity of reason. Where we are from, there are no crimes of passion, because there is no passion. Where we are from, there is no remorse, because action has a logical motive and always results in the best outcome for the given situation. Where we are from, there are no names, no families living together, no husbands and wives, no sulky teenagers, no madness. Where we are from, we have solved the problem of fear, because we have solved the problem of death. We will not die, which means we can't just let the universe do what it wants to do, because we will be inside it for eternity. Where we are from, we will never be lying on a luxurious carpet, clutching our chest as our faces turn purple and our eyes seek desperately to view our surroundings for one last time. Where we are from, our technology, created on the back of our supreme and comprehensive knowledge of mathematics, has meant not only that we can travel great distances, but also that we can rearrange our own biological ingredients, renew and replenish them. We are psychologically equipped for such advances. We have never been at war with ourselves. We never place the desires of the individual over the requirements of the collective. Where we are from, we understand that if the human's rate of mathematical advancement exceeds their psychological maturity, then action needs to be taken. For instance, the death of Daniel Russell and the knowledge he held could end up saving many more lives. And so, he is a logical and justifiable sacrifice. Where we are from, there are no nightmares. And yet, that night, for the very first time in my life, I had a nightmare. A world of dead humans with me and that indifferent cat walking through a giant carpeted street full of bodies. I was trying to get home, but I couldn't. I was stuck here. I had become one of them, stuck in human form, unable to escape the inevitable fate awaiting all of them. And I was getting hungry, and I needed to eat, but I couldn't eat because my mouth was clamped shut. The hunger became extreme. I was starving, wasting away at rapid speed. I went to the garage I had been in that first night and tried to shove food in my mouth, but it was no good. It was still locked from this inexplicable paralysis. I knew I was going to die. Die? How did humans ever stomach the idea? I woke. I was sweating and out of breath. Isabel touched my back. "It's all right," she said. As Tabitha had said, "It's all right, it's all right, it's all right." The dog and the music. The next day I was alone. Well, no, actually, that's not quite true. I wasn't alone. There was the dog, Newton. The dog, named after a human who had come up with the ideas of gravity and inertia. Given the slow speed with which the dog left its basket, I realized the name was a fitting tribute to these discoveries. He was awake now. He was old, and he hobbled, and he was half blind. He knew who I was, or who I wasn't, and he growled whenever he was near me. I didn't quite understand his language just yet, but I sensed he was displeased. He showed his teeth, but I could tell years of subservience to his bipedal owners meant the very fact that I was standing up was enough for me to command a certain degree of respect. I felt sick. I put this down to the new air I was breathing. But each time I closed my eyes, I saw Daniel Russell's anguished face as he lay on the carpet. I also had a headache, but that was the lingering after-effect of the energy I had exerted yesterday. I knew life was going to be easier during my short stay here if Newton was on my side. He might have information, have picked up on signals, heard things. And I knew there was one rule that held fast across the universe. If you wanted to get someone on your side, what you really had to do was relieve their pain. It seems ridiculous now, such logic. But the truth was even more ridiculous, and too dangerous to acknowledge to myself, that after the need to hurt, I felt an urge to heal. So I went over and gave him a biscuit. And then after giving him the biscuit, I gave him sight. And then, as I stroked his hind leg, he whimpered words into my ear I couldn't quite translate. I healed him, giving myself not only an even more intense headache, but also wave upon wave of fatigue in the process. Indeed, so exhausted was I that I fell asleep on the kitchen floor. When I woke up, I was coated in dog saliva. Newton's tongue was still at it, licking me with considerable enthusiasm. Licking, 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 as though the meaning of canine existence was something just beneath my skin. "Could you please stop that?" I said. But he couldn't. Not until I stood up. He was physically incapable of stopping. And even once I had stood up, he tried to stand up with me, and on me, as if he wanted to be upright too. It was then I realized the one thing worse than having a dog hate you is having a dog love you. Seriously, if there was a needier species in the universe, I had yet to meet it. "Get away," I told him. "I don't want your love." I went to the living room and sat down on the sofa. I needed to think. Would Daniel Russell's death be viewed by the humans as suspicious? A man on heart medication succumbing to a second and this time fatal heart attack. I had no poison and no weapon they would ever be able to identify. The dog sat down next to me, placed his head on my lap, then lifted his head off my lap and then on again, as if deciding whether or not to put his head on my lap was the biggest decision he had ever faced. We spent hours together that day, me and the dog. At first I was annoyed that he wouldn't leave me alone, as what I needed to do was to focus and work out when I was going to act next, to work out how much more information I needed to acquire before doing what would have to be my final acts here, eliminating Andrew Martin's wife and child. I shouted at the dog again to leave me alone, and he did so. But when I stood in the living room with nothing but my thoughts and plans, I realized I felt a terrible loneliness, and so called him back. And he came, and seemed happy to be wanted again. I put something on that interested me. It was called The Planets by Gustav Holst. It was a piece of music all about the humans' puny solar system, so it was surprising to hear it had quite an epic feel. Another confusing thing was that it was divided into 7 movements, each named after astrological characters. For instance, Mars was the bringer of war, Jupiter was the bringer of jollity, and Saturn was the bringer of old age. This primitivism struck me as funny, and so was the idea that the music had anything whatsoever to do with those dead planets. But it seemed to soothe Newton a little bit, and I must admit one or two parts of it had some kind of effect on me, a kind of electrochemical effect. Listening to music, I realized, was simply the pleasure of counting without realizing you were counting. As the electrical impulses were transported from the neurons in my ear through my body, I felt, I don't know, calm. It made that strange unease that had been with me since I had watched Daniel Russell die on his carpet settle a little. As we listened, I tried to work out why Newton and his species were so enamored of humans. "Tell me," I said, "what is it about the humans?" Newton laughed, or as close as a dog can get to laughing, which is pretty close. I persisted with my line of inquiry. "Go on," I said. "Spill the beans. He seemed a bit coy. I don't think he really had an answer. Maybe he hadn't reached his verdict, or he was too loyal to be truthful. I put on some different music. I played the music of someone called Ennio Morricone. I played an album called Space Oddity by David Bowie, which, in its simple patterned measure of time, was actually quite enjoyable, as was Moon Safari by Air, though that shed little light on the moon itself. I played A Love Supreme by John Coltrane and Blue Monk by Thelonious Monk. This was jazz music. It was full of the complexity and contradictions that I would soon learn made humans human. I listened to Rhapsody in Blue by George Gershwin and Moonlight Sonata by Ludwig van Beethoven and Brahms' Intermezzo Opus 117. I listened to The Beatles, The Beach Boys, The Rolling Stones, Daft Punk, Prince, Talking Heads, Al Green, Tom Waits, Mozart. I was intrigued to discover the sounds that could make it onto music. The strange talking radio voice on I Am the Walrus by the Beatles, the cough at the beginning of Prince's Raspberry Beret, and at the end of Tom Waits' songs. Maybe that is what beauty was for humans. Accidents, imperfections placed inside a pretty pattern, asymmetry, the defiance of mathematics. I thought about my speech at the Museum of Quadratic Equations. With the Beach Boys, I got a strange feeling behind my eyes and in my stomach. I had no idea what that feeling was, but it made me think of Isabel and the way she had hugged me last night after I'd come home and told her Daniel Russell had suffered a fatal heart attack in front of me. There'd been a slight moment of suspicion, a brief hardening of her stare, but it had softened into compassion. Whatever else she might have thought about her husband, he wasn't a killer. The last thing I listened to was a tune called Clair de Lune by Debussy. That was the closest representation of space I had ever heard, and I stood there in the middle of the room, frozen with shock that a human could have made such a beautiful noise. This beauty terrified me, like an alien creature appearing out of nowhere. An ipsoid bursting out of the desert. I had to stay focused. I had to keep believing everything I had been told, that this was a species of ugliness and violence beyond redemption. Newton was scratching at the front door. The scratching was putting me off the music, so I went over and tried to decipher what he wanted. It turned out that what he wanted was to go outside. There was a lead I had seen Isabel use, and so I attached it to the collar. As I walked the dog, I tried to think more negatively towards the humans. And it certainly seemed ethically questionable, the relationship between humans and dogs, both of whom, on the scale of intelligence that covered every species in the universe, would have been somewhere in the middle, not too far apart. But I have to say that dogs didn't seem to mind it. In fact, they went along quite happily with the setup most of the time. I let Newton lead the way. We passed a man on the other side of the road. The man just stopped and stared at me and smiled to himself. I smiled and waved my hand, understanding this was an appropriate human greeting. He didn't wave back. Yes, humans are a troubling species. We carried on walking, and we passed another man. A man in a wheelchair. He seemed to know me.
Andrew, he said. Isn't it terrible, the news about Daniel Russell?
Yes, I said. I was there. I saw it happen. It was horrible. Just horrible. Oh, my God, I had no idea. Mortality is a very tragic thing.
Indeed. Indeed it is.
Anyway, I'd better be going. The dog is in quite a hurry. I will see you.
Yes, yes, absolutely. But may I ask, how are you? I'd heard you'd been a bit unwell yourself.
Oh, fine, I'm over that. It was just a bit of a misunderstanding, really.
Oh, I see.
The conversation dwindled further, and I made my excuses, Newton dragging me forward until we reached a large stretch of grass. This is what dogs liked to do, I discovered. They liked to run around on grass, pretending they were free, shouting, we're free, look, 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 how free we are, at each other. It really was a sorry sight. But it worked for them, and for Newton in particular. It was a collective illusion they had chosen to swallow, and they were submitting to it wholeheartedly, without any nostalgia for their former wolf selves. That was the remarkable thing about humans, their ability to shape the path of other species, to change their fundamental nature. Maybe it could happen to me. Maybe I could be changed. Maybe I already was being changed. Who knew? I hope not. I hoped I was staying as pure as I had been told, as strong and isolated as a prime, as a 97. I sat on a bench and watched the traffic. No matter how long I stayed on this planet, I doubted I would ever get used to the sight of cars, bound by gravity and poor technology to the road, hardly moving on the roads because there were so many of them. Was it wrong to thwart a species' technological advancement? That was a new question in my mind. I didn't want it there, so I was quite relieved when Newton started barking. I turned to look at him. He was standing still, his head steady in one direction, as he carried on making as loud a noise as he possibly could. Look, he seemed to bark. Look, look, look! I was picking up his language. There was another road, a different one to the one with all the traffic, a line of terraced houses facing the park. I turned towards it, as Newton clearly wanted me to do. I saw Gulliver, on his own, walking along the pavement, trying his best to hide behind his hair. He was meant to be at school, and he wasn't, unless human school was walking along the street and thinking, which it really should have been. He saw me. He froze, and then he turned around and started walking in the other direction. Gulliver! I called. Gulliver! He ignored me. If anything, he started walking away faster than he had done before. His behaviour concerned me. After all, inside his head was the knowledge that the world's biggest mathematical puzzle had been solved, and by his own father. I hadn't acted last night. I told myself that I needed to find more information, check there was no one else Andrew Martin could have told. Also, I was probably too exhausted after my encounter with Daniel. I would wait another day, maybe even two. That had been the plan. Gulliver had told me he hadn't said anything, and that he wasn't going to. But how could he be totally trusted? His mother was convinced right now that he was at school, and yet he evidently wasn't. I got up from the bench and walked over the litter-strewn grass to where Newton was still barking. Come on, I said, realizing I should probably have acted already. We have to go. We arrived on the road just as Gulliver was turning off it, and so I decided to follow him and see where he was going. At one point he stopped and took something from his pocket. A box. He took out a cylindrical object and put it in his mouth and lit it. He turned around, but I had sensed he would, and was already hiding behind a tree. He began walking again. Soon he reached a larger road. Coleridge Road, this one was called. He didn't want to be on this road for long. Too many cars, too many opportunities to be seen. He kept on walking, and after a while the buildings stopped, and there were no cars or people any more. I was worried he was going to turn around, because there were no nearby trees or anything else to hide behind. Also, although I was physically near enough to be easily seen if he did turn to look, I was too far for any mind manipulation to work. Remarkably, though, he didn't turn around again. Not once. We passed a building with lots of empty cars outside, shining in the sun. The building had the word Honda on it. There was a man inside the glass in a shirt and tie watching us. Gulliver then cut across a grass field. Eventually he reached four metal tracks in the ground, parallel lines, close together but stretching as far as the eye could see. He just stood there, absolutely still, waiting for something. Newton looked at Gulliver and then up at me, with concern. He let out a deliberately loud whine.
"Shh," I said. "Keep quiet."
After a while, a train appeared in the distance, getting closer as it was carried along the tracks. I noticed Gulliver's fists clench and his whole body stiffen as he stood only a metre or so away from the train's path. As the train was about to pass where he was standing, Newton barked, but the train was too loud and too close to Gulliver for him to hear. This was interesting. Maybe I wouldn't have to do anything. Maybe Gulliver was going to do it himself. The train passed. Gulliver's hands stopped being fists, and he seemed to relax again. Or maybe it was disappointment. But before he turned around and started walking away, I had dragged Newton back, and we were out of sight. Grigory Perelman. So I had left Gulliver, untouched, unharmed. I'd returned home with Newton while Gulliver had carried on walking. I had no idea where he was going, but it was pretty clear to me from his lack of direction that he hadn't been heading anywhere specific. I concluded, therefore, that he wasn't going to meet someone. Indeed, he had seemed to want to avoid people. Still, I knew it was dangerous. I knew that it wasn't just proof of the Riemann hypothesis which was the problem. It was knowledge that it could be proved, and Gulliver had that knowledge inside his skull as he walked around the streets. Yet I justified my delay because I'd been told to be patient. I'd been told to find out exactly who knew. If human progress was to be thwarted, then I needed to be thorough. To kill Gulliver now would have been premature, because his death and that of his mother would be the last acts I could commit before suspicions were aroused. Yes, this is what I told myself, as I unclipped Newton's lead and re-entered the house, and then accessed that sitting-room computer, typing in the words Poincaré conjecture into the search box. Soon I found Isabel had been right. This conjecture, concerning a number of very basic topological laws about spheres and four-dimensional space, had been solved by a Russian mathematician called Grigory Perelman. On the 18th of March, 2010, just over 3 years ago, it was announced that he had won a Clay Millennium Prize. But he had turned it down, and the $1 million that had gone with it. "I'm not interested in money or fame," he had said. "I don't want to be on display like an animal in a zoo. I'm not a hero of mathematics." This was not the only prize he had been offered. There had been others. A prestigious prize from the European Mathematical Society, one from the International Congress of Mathematicians in Madrid, and the Fields Medal, the highest award in mathematics. All of them he had turned down, choosing instead to live a life of poverty and unemployment, caring for his elderly mother. Humans are arrogant. Humans are greedy. They care about nothing but money and fame. They do not appreciate mathematics for its own sake, but for what it can get them. I logged out. Suddenly I felt weak. I was hungry. That must have been it. So I went to the kitchen and looked for food. Crunchy whole nut peanut butter. I ate some capers, and then a stock cube, and chewed on a stick-like vegetable called celery. Eventually I got out some bread, a staple of human cuisine, and I looked in the cupboard for something to put on it. Caster sugar was my first option, and then I tried some mixed herbs. Neither was very satisfying. After much anxious trepidation and analysis of the nutritional information, I decided to try something called crunchy whole nut peanut butter. I placed it on the bread and gave some to the dog. He liked it. "Should I try it?" I asked him. "Yes, you definitely should," appeared to be the response. Dog words weren't really words, they were more like melodies. Silent melodies sometimes, but melodies all the same. "It is very tasty indeed." He wasn't wrong. As I placed it in my mouth and began to chew, I realized that human food could actually be quite good. I'd never enjoyed food before. Now I came to think of it, I'd never enjoyed anything before.
And yet today, even amid my strange feelings of weakness and doubt, I had experienced the pleasures of music and of food, and maybe even the simple enjoyment of canine company. After I had eaten one piece of bread and peanut butter, I made another one for us both, and then another, Newton's appetite proving to be at least a match for mine. "I'm not what I am," I told him at one stage. "You know that, don't you? I mean, that is why you were so hostile at first, why you growled whenever I was near you. You sensed it, didn't you? More than a human could. You knew there was a difference." His silence spoke volumes, and as I stared into his glassy, honest eyes, I felt the urge to tell him more. "I've killed someone," I told him, feeling a sense of relief. "I am what a human would categorize as a murderer, a judgmental term, and based in this case on the wrong judgments. You see, sometimes to save something you have to kill a little piece of it. But still, a murderer, that is what they would call me if they knew. Not that they would ever really be able to know how I had done it. You see, as you no doubt know, humans are still at the point in their development where they see a strong difference between the mental and the physical within the same body. They have mental hospitals and body hospitals, as if one doesn't directly affect the other. And so if they can't accept that a mind is directly responsible for the body of the same person,